Good evening, welcome to another session with Betty and Paul Picard. Tonight we've entitled our session, "The Reservoir of Greed, an Examination of Christianity and Capitalism." I'm glad to see all of you here. I was very much afraid after I talked too long yesterday, nobody'd come back. So I'm glad you're here. And for those of you who haven't been with us before, another thing I'd like to start out with is to assure you how glad we are that we're here. We've been having a really great time at Holden, and hope it's great for all of you as well. One of the things I've been fiddling with is a kind of a counter-Bible. It seems to me that most of the stuff I see in the Bible, particularly in the Gospels, is slanted or biased in favor of poor people, and it has very little to offer for those who are seeking success in terms of the American way of life. The American way of life seems to extol one set of virtues, such as ambition, competence, you know, ability, skill, and the Bible seems to me to kind of gloss over those, at times even to treat them negatively. I've tried out a number of biblical passages to see how they might go if the Bible were written so that Americans could be more comfortable with it. Well, not only Americans, but other people with so-called Western developed societies. Jesus said, "The kingdom of God is like a well-run corporation. Everyone has assignments and is accountable to the managers, and the managers answer to the Father. People do what they're told without presuming to participate in the Father's decision-making. Better people are given better assignments, more interesting, with less work, and greater rewards. Inferior people are given the hardest tasks, numbing, fatiguing, and the fewest rewards." And they asked him, "Who are the better people, and who the inferior?" And Jesus replied, "The better people are the ones who wrote the rules, so that their skills could fulfill their ambitions. And the inferior people are those whose skills are outlawed or who shun ambition." Well, I hope you don't see that as blasphemous, but rather as a way of suggesting that the altogether different tone that the scriptures might take if they could genuinely buttress the American capitalist ethic. I'm not going to let this introduction run longer than 10 minutes, and I've already used half of it. But let me continue a little further. It would be presumptuous of me to say that Jesus comes down on the side of one particular economic order and is opposed to the others. I am not even tempted to that presumption, because I do agree that with Larry Rasmussen, the program director for this summer, and the man who invited Betty and me to come. So if you're unhappy with this, let him know. But Larry has a very nice, very elementary pamphlet in the library on Christianity and capitalism, and he says Jesus doesn't come down on any one side, that Jesus isn't a capitalist, Jesus isn't a socialist, and Larry actually deals with shades, degrees of capitalism and degrees of socialism. So I want to put that up front, that I don't think we can argue that the Bible or the Gospels specify one economic system. So that isn't our task tonight. And for those of us who participated in the forum on different occupations and how does one blend one's Christianity with one's occupational choice, it seems again very clear that there's room for good Christians in a great variety of different jobs. That there's a lot of dirty work that has to be done in any society. It's hard to imagine any society in the world we live in without a military establishment, without a police department, without a garbage collection, sanitary service, slaughterhouse, and so on. So there are a lot of unpleasant jobs that have to be done, and it seems clear that good Christians, good people, good motivation, good faith can fulfill most of these jobs in the society. But that still leaves us with the problem for this evening, and is there something in the driving force of capitalism which poses a problem when set up against the driving force of Christianity? Does capitalism call forth a different set of values than Christianity? What is the tension between them? What is the conflict between them? We use the title "A Reservoir of Greed" to acknowledge that there is a reservoir of greed in each one of us, that we all suffer a certain stain. Some people don't like it when I refer to it as original sin, but I suppose most of you can accept that notion. I don't believe only in original sin. I believe also in our capacity to love. I believe in redemption. But I do believe we are, when you talk about what is human nature, we are fundamentally stained. And one of the stains is this greed, the temptation towards acquiring for ourselves. And it seemed to me that some economic systems work on that greed more than others, that some political appeals are aimed more at that greed in us than at the love in us. Let me try and work some more ideas in as we move along with more conversation and more participation with the rest of you. Have I said anything to get you started? I got to warn those of you who weren't here yesterday that I can go on by myself, but it doesn't work well. I was very satisfied with what I said yesterday.
Let me say one suggestion.
Please.
That I got from some of the things you said concerning the capacity to love and then greed within us as well. The fairly obvious point about the Nazis and the communists is they certainly didn't breed up critics within their own regime or to have them there. There's something about Christianity and capitalists or Christian, there is always a potentiality of a powerful critical and moral sense living in the capitalist. American philanthropy, Carnegie, the Scottish Lead in Scotland, I think this is some residue of that, John D. Rockefeller, the Baptist background, some residue of that. Therefore, a society which has a religion which, even if it doesn't make some difference, can still build up a conscience and still nurture critics, where even one who is a capitalist can have some doubts that everything he is doing is wonderful. The New Yorker cartoon of 1938 showed Hitler before the Bundestag, and Hitler says, "And I think I may say without fear of contradiction." A capitalist in this country, and in the past, cannot do and say everything without fear of contradiction. And some of the contradiction is within the capitalist himself, who is a fellow traveler of Christ. Judge Learned Hand affected me a long time ago at the end of the Second World War when all the horrors were being opened up. It was at Christmas, 1945, when Learned Hand, the great judge of the New York Circuit Court, says, "The birthday of Christ, who lived on this world, and his message we have never quite learned but never quite forgotten." So in our big capitalist and all that, we have a seed of Christ where he has not quite affected their lives, but they have not quite forgotten what he said.
Thank you. You are suggesting there's a contradiction then.
There is, a sort of a contradiction, yes. A capitalism without some kind of limits, internal or external, can be a bad thing. But a capitalism with certain kind of restraints on it, some of them from Christ, can be a humanistic thing.
Any response to that?
Well, the real question, I think, in capitalism is where doesn't it work? Where does it lead to excesses? And probably some of those areas is where we're talking about monopoly power. That is where the market forces are really not distributing goods and services effectively, or in the case of oligopolies, and such as the automobile industry, by way of illustration. And in those areas, we find, I think, that capitalism does not work extremely well and can get out of hand where there isn't some sort of countervailing force, either from government or from the marketplace itself. Surprisingly, however, the marketplace is able to even respond to oligopolies rather well, as evidenced by the fix that the automobile industry is in right now. And we see that, you see, that the Japanese automobile makers are making a much more attractive car for the current problems that the consumer is facing. But the real threat, I think, is corporations that can get outside of our government influence, outside of the market influence, and establish monopoly power on a worldwide basis without any countervailing force. And when that happens, we see all kinds of bad things taking place.
Let me try to unravel two things that I pick out of what you're saying. One is that there's a difference between the way capitalism operates in a society and the doctrines of laissez-faire, free enterprise, free market, and so on. Now, I'd like us to spend a lot of our time dealing with it in principle, as though that difference weren't there. But I think it's very helpful for you to remind us that there is that difference there, that whenever people in business are given the freedom of the market, their first effort is to destroy that free market. Adam Smith, the great patron saint, one might say, of laissez-faire. Some of you will remember when Adam Smith published his book, Wealth of Nations. It's a very easy date for Americans to remember.
1776.
Right, Americans can always remember that, I think. There's a beautiful irony in this Scottish university professor writing in the 18th century and finding 200 years later that all hard-headed, practical American businessmen and politicians and so on are citing his wisdom as though it were gospel. Most professors don't get that kind of respect from business. Perhaps what has to happen is for the professor to be so hopelessly out of date that the professor would repudiate that position. And at that same time, then the practical business people can adopt it. Now, but Smith said, men in the same business hardly ever get together, even for merriment and entertainment. But the result is a conspiracy against the public. And that's why we have, as a fundamental contradiction in the notion of a free market system and the notion of free enterprise, absolutely critical to the whole notion is the antitrust legislation, which is now 90 years old in this country. Starting in 1890, the government of the United States had tried to had tried to outlaw not only monopolies, which are very rare, but also combinations in restraint of trade and conspiracies to restrain trade. And that kind of government influence is critical to the definition of a free market, that without government interference, one can't have freedom. That's true not only in economics, but it's true in all kinds of other areas, isn't it? We don't really get freedom in the jungle. We get freedom with order. So in practice, capitalism has turned out to commit all kinds of monstrous offenses, hasn't it? In this country, we maintain, as just standard operating procedure over the last few years, somewhere in the order of 5, 6, 7 million people looking for work. I'm not talking about how many people are not working. We maintain 5, 6, 7 million people looking for work, unable to find it. Very important to the whole system that when they do get a job, they remember when they didn't have one. They remember that although they got their job, they got it at somebody else's expense, and there's still 5, 6, 7 million other people out there waiting for that job. It's a marvelous way of disciplining the workforce. It's a marvelous way of keeping the labor unions under control, that all these marginal American workers know they're dispensable. They can be replaced. Now, it's not a necessary condition of work. You know, you look at some other occupations, higher skill occupations, the table is the other way around. There are more university presidencies around than there are university presidents. So there are always vacancies in university presidencies. They're always looking for a president. But that's not true of this lower level. I take that to be an atrocity of modern capitalism. It has 6 million people, more or less, looking for work and unable to find it. It seems to me the least any economic system could do is provide work for those who want to work. If somebody wants to work, let's put them to work. And I take that to be one of the major causes of inflation in this country today. We have millions of people who aren't working, but who are nevertheless consuming. Another atrocity of capitalism in practice seems to be the exploitation of underdeveloped areas. Whether the Yankee exploitation of the South or the American exploitation of Central America or the British exploitation of parts of Asia and Africa. You know, it's hard to overlook all those in practice. But I think our problem tonight can be more theoretical. That's a naughty word for some of you, but I mean it in a good sense, that we can try here to withdraw a little from the hard practical failures of capitalism and just try and examine the notion of capitalism. I don't mean to let capitalism off the hook with that slight, you know, two-count indictment I made. I'm sure many of you could provide a much better indictment of capitalism in practice. But let's look at it in principle. In what is the nature of capitalism? Contrasted with the nature of Christianity. Yes?
Are you going to define that for me, please? What capitalism is?
Well, I hope to be able to slip by it. Has someone got a good working definition of capitalism? I guess I could give something of a definition of it.
My chief is still here.
Well, that's not enough. I think any kind of trade, barter economy would also, one would try to buy cheap and sell dear. But capitalism involves the accumulation of, afraid to use trigger words here, but surplus wealth, which can be invested for future development. It involves building up of artificial entities, which we call corporations. It's kind of nice to see how different capitalist countries call it. I just learned a few of them. Here, you know, it's INC, I-N-C. And what does that mean? In Britain, what do they call it? Canada, some in the United States.
Limited.
What does that mean?
Limited liability.
It's a little more upfront, isn't it? It says, if we go bankrupt, you can't get at us as people. You can only get at our company. And in French and Spanish, what is it? You've seen it, S-A, for society, excuse me, let me say it in English, anonymous society. So that what you're dealing with an anonymous group of people. You're dealing with the IBM Corporation, the General Motors Corporation, the Chrysler Corporation. You're not dealing with identifiable people. You're not dealing with people who are going to back the corporation with their own money. You're dealing with people who buy into it and use the corporation as a shield between them and their customers and the public and so on. The Chrysler Corporation is quite willing to lobby in Washington for major support from the government. The government doesn't want to give it direct support, so that we fix it up so that the bankers will be the ones who come out ahead. So the government guarantees the loan, so the bankers get to make a no-risk loan. That's more description than definition, I'm afraid. But by capitalism, we are talking about an economy of private but corporate ownership with the accumulation of profits beyond the current requirements of the business. Please.
I think you also need to add the allocation of scarce resources within a free market system. If you don't include that, you're just looking at one side of capitalism.
Yes. That's very difficult for me. All economies try to allocate scarce resources. And capitalist economies do not necessarily rely on a free market system for doing it. It's a major characteristic of right-wing dictatorships to preserve capitalism. The German capitalists found Hitler very attractive to start with, and many of them stayed with him right to the end and were able to make good profits up until very near the end. And certainly a major characteristic of Franco's dictatorship in Spain was the preservation of capitalism, but without any semblance of a free market. So American capitalism pays lip service to the free market, which is imposed on it by law. The businesses of this country, the corporate businesses of this country, as they grew following old people in North Florida and Georgia called the war between the states. You know, what you learned of is the Civil War. As those corporations grew, the corporate managers were not the ones who lobbied for the Sherman Antitrust Act. That's a semblance of a free market is imposed on them. Not a genuine free market, never has been.
I'm curious, when you posed your original question, did I catch the implication that Christianity is an economic system? Isn't Christianity, in fact, a way of life that can be lived under numerous different kinds of economic systems?
Yes. I'm glad you nailed that down. I thought I meant to say specifically that Jesus doesn't come down on one side or the other. It's possible to be a Christian in any economy. But I'm asking if you see a tension between the thrust of Christianity and the thrust of capitalism. No, I wouldn't call Christianity an economic system, but I would say Christianity is a pervasive way of life. It deals not only with our great 11 o'clock Sunday morning, but it deals with every other aspect of our lives, and including the economic.
Well, to some extent, this gentleman behind me suggested a part of an answer to that, in that some people who, because they are living under the capitalistic economic system, but at the same time are Christians, become, as they become wealthy, they become philanthropic. In fact, I think that's why Holden Village is here.
I don't think so. I think Holden Village is here because of a tax write-off. I don't think it was a philanthropic gesture on the part of the corporation. But I must hasten to add, I say this without knowing any of the people who made the decision. I do not know at all what they were thinking. All I've been told is the history that West wrote to them over a period of 4 years. And the first couple of times they said no because you couldn't come up with a price. But by the end of the fourth year, what had happened was that they could, by giving it to a nonprofit organization, get a tax write-off that would give them as much as they had asked for the first year. So they, I'm sure, on their books, they came out just fine. But but it could have been an act of great Christian charity at the same time. I don't know what was going on.
It goes beyond how sound. I think you're talking about how sound. I think he's talking about the individuals who put their capital into this place at the very beginning, with which it could not exist at the moment.
Holden Village couldn't exist without philanthropy. As I understand it, the paying guests here are paying something on the order of two-thirds of the cost. Is that right?
60%.
I've heard 60 and 70. It definitely requires philanthropy to keep it going, yes. Yes. I'm not sure what. Oh, please.
Well, if you're talking about countervailing forces, I would like to see, in some way or another, the developing of worker participation in corporations. In a much, much larger sense than what it's been so far. I think it's been successfully tried in European countries, in a number of places. I'm talking about the Western European countries. And it seems to me this could begin to give a healthy corrective to certain kinds of excesses which you find corporations doing when they move out of a community and leave it helpless in the face of the economic depression that follows. And that there could be many ways that worker participation could begin to correct some of that. One that's more theoretical that hasn't happened, as far as I know, that extensively yet in any place would be to democratize the stockholder portion of corporations much more than what it is, and to give participation within the stockholding kinds of procedures, that side of it, democratic voting within that kind of circumstance. And this might be the beginning of some countervailing forces that perhaps could correct a number of the excesses that are involved with multinationals.
Now again, aren't you addressing yourself to kind of some practical considerations?
Yeah.
But I wonder if you're getting at the principle at all. It would seem to me there is a, we've already reached the point where the workers and the management are often in agreement with each other on how to put it to the rest of it.
In America, I don't think there's much real participation except
no.
In the very, very beginning sense in the affairs of the corporation itself. And it just seems to me that it's imperative.
I think that's entirely right, but what I'm suggesting is that as long as we're talking about advancing the corporate interest, if we give the workers a greater share in that, and we avoided the possible conflict between a corporate interest of the corporation getting ahead, the corporation making its profit, and the counterclaims of a non-corporate interest, of a public interest, or of a Christian interest.
Well,
go ahead.
I just think that I'm not arguing that these are the only countervailing forces that we need. I think government involvement is necessary too. I think the balance could be struck much better. I don't know every kind of consequence out of that, but someplace, in view of the fact, I don't think that other kinds of changes that might be helpful are going to happen. These are two directions that might begin to correct certain kinds of things, and perhaps would even have a certain kind of weight with regard to excesses of corporations in third world countries, where I think one sees the structure of it really having some demonic sides. I just think that there is a great deal of greed that's represented in certain aspects of what corporations have done, and a great deal of indifference, which is certainly characterized in the automobile industry, which ignored many, many pleas in many, many places that they build smaller cars, and now all of us are paying for the consequences of a decision of a very few people that they didn't want to do that back in the beginnings of the 70s when everybody began to see that this was necessary.
Let me pursue it and remember which way to go. Thank you. One of the great things about Holden Village is we bring lots of different people together with lots of different backgrounds and skills and talents, and when we're talking with people, we don't always know what their occupation is outside of here. And it's certainly possible that we have with us some labor union leaders. If you like them, if you don't like them, we call them bosses, don't we? I would just say, generally, I tend to vote with those people. My sympathy tends to be with them. But I think it's important for those of us who are sympathetic to them and who think they may be a good influence, not to glamorize them. It seems to me that the motto of American workers is exactly the same as the motto of American corporate owners, the stockholders. And it's a one-word motto. What is it?
Profit.
More. More. It doesn't matter how much you give an American worker. It doesn't matter how much you raise the minimum wage. The worker's response is, I want more. And it doesn't matter how much you pay a stockholder in dividends. Doesn't matter what their rate of return is on their investment or on the current value. What they want out of that corporation is more. And so I agree with what you're saying, Joe, that given the somewhat more liberal tendencies of more democratic groups like labor unions, they would perhaps ameliorate some of the behavior of the corporation, but the workers and the corporate owners both want to maximize the size of the corporate pie. Then they fight over the angle of their slice.
That hasn't been as much the experience, say, in the German German way of handling the that labor management thing. And it seems to me that it tends to moderate both things rather than being always antagonists. They begin to see other kinds of issues that are involved. For instance, Mercedes-Benz only makes so many cars a year. It doesn't project trying to make a hugely exciting kind of market situation, and it creates some balance in the country. And now Volkswagen has the same kind of policy. It seems to me, instead of just trying to flood the market with something that will make a lot of profits for a little bit, and then suddenly it's all over, as has been the tendency in our own economy, that we do ourselves a great deal, give ourselves a great deal of wisdom in terms of how we go at things if we did some things like that. And I think that's come about largely because of a lot of dialogue that's going on between labor and management there.
I hope everybody's digesting those remarks. Thank you very much. Where was the
One of the things that I think is a contributing factor to some of the ills that capitalism creates is the very present situation that the owner, the stockholder, is impersonally related to the activities of the corporation. And if you investigate that idea in Scripture, you find it's an idea that is, if you trace it down through the Old Testament, it's an idea that's on very shaky moral ground from a scriptural viewpoint. The idea that one can be divorced from the consequences of their investment.
Dan, someone told me the Lutherans made a point of not investing in tobacco and something else. No?
That's been on the books in terms of policy for ALC investment for some time, and has been brought up recently in regard to South Africa protest because a precedent has already been set, so to speak.
All right, was there a hand over here I've been missing? Rudy?
I'd like to suggest that the individual in our country, where we supposedly have a capitalistic system, is really the market. And we vote. We vote specifically every time we spend a dollar. And our vote really is that spending of the dollar. And what corporations do depends on how we as citizens vote on their product. And if we continue to spend and make it attractive for any corporation in whatever commodity or product they deal, if we make it attractive, then you can't really just fault the corporation. We tend to find scapegoats, and we tend to pass the buck to somebody else. But really, the real problem is with ourselves.
Well,
we don't vote right.
That's a strong argument in favor of a theoretical free market, isn't it? In practice, we don't get a free vote, do we?
Well, why don't we?
Well, for just a whole variety of reasons. Some are just a result of the way we're manipulated, the way we are influenced in our vote, that no man is an island. We all are mixed up with each other, and we get influenced in some ways that might be considered artificial. The amount of money that's spent on advertising in this country, for example, is not all wasted money. I think a lot of it is wasted. We drove around Vermont the other day. Some of you have been around Oregon. I think I'm told it's the same there, where they just have virtually gotten rid of billboards. It's possible for business to be successful without some advertising, I think. But I don't think all these business people who are spending all that money on advertising are wasting all their money. I think they're getting something in return for it. But there's another difficulty in principle, and that is that there are a lot of situations in which the individual's immediate self-interest contradicts the society's long-run interest. In the short run, what's best for me may add up, when we take in everybody else's views, everybody else's decision, to quite a monstrosity. And we see this most simply in the field of something like air pollution or water pollution. I can stop driving a car and thereby have an absolutely insignificant impact on the level of pollution. And I will suffer major discomfort. We have virtually no public transport in our town. There's a little, but it's completely inadequate. If all my neighbors would vote the same way I did and say we're only going to use our cars for extraordinary occasions, I don't want to buy gasoline twice a month the way I have to now. I'd rather just buy it once a month or even less. And I'd rather be able to walk down to the corner and read my newspaper on the way to work in public transport. But until my neighbors agree with me, I can't do it. So I continue to vote in favor of the gasoline company. I continue to go out and pay my dollars for gasoline that I don't want. But it makes sense for me to do it anyway. So that there's a that's one of the, you know, a major tension between the free market and public conscience. Yes.
I think this ties in with, you know, some of your theoretical foundations, those sorts of questions you started with, and I guess it's something I've been wrestling with for some time, the idea that, number one, has been stated here by different people, that capitalism basically runs, and correct me if I'm wrong, on the idea or the goal of maximizing profits, whether it's one individual or a corporation. That's what keeps the system operating, maximizing profits. My question, and I think I have an answer myself, my problem is working out the practical consequences. The question is, there are other motivating factors for alternative economic systems. There are other things to motivate people than maximizing profits. And I think our question here is that the best motivating factor to go with our Christian faith? Or are there other motivating factors
And can you also say at the same time, are some of these motivations more in keeping with the gospel than others?
That's just what I'm saying. Asking.
Now, this time, for some reason, we all know that we have been conned by the communists and the Republicans into believing that we are economic creatures. We have been conned into believing that we live according to economic motivation. And it simply isn't true. It's not true of any of us. Think of all the important decisions we make which are not economically sound decisions, like all the volunteers who helped make this place go. It doesn't make economic sense to come up here and wash dishes for nothing. It doesn't make economic sense to drop money into a collection plate when you're in a strange church and nobody's going to give you any credit for it, except you know who. That doesn't make economic sense, does it? And look at your choice of a spouse. Tell me you did that economically. Or if you're not married, your choice of a roommate. Was that an economic decision? This woman married an undergraduate student with no job. Didn't make sense. So, quite clearly, we are not just economic. I think that's where the communist and free market people are farthest off. The so-called libertarians are farthest off in trying to understand us. That there's a lot more to us. There's a lot more contradiction in us. Yes?
As a Christian, I have a lot of problem with the fact that corporations are so anonymous. If I have money invested in, say, the Nestle company, and then I find out that they pulled this canned milk baby formula scam in Africa, and I'm appalled, you know, do I sell my stock or write the company? You know, I have to find out, and it's difficult to find out what is going on. And, you know, and then I have this conflict of interest as a person who would never do anything like that. On an individual basis, do I allow, you know, this company that's got my money to do that? And I see some real problems for Christians. It's not as bad if you're just a little person who's contributing your sweat to somebody else's profits. You know, you've got comfort in the Bible because the Bible's full of little poor people, and you could identify with that. But it's a real difficult thing when you might be the person who's benefiting, you know, from that unearned profit.
I think along with that same issue is the fact that even within the corporate structures, the idea of the limited responsibility, if in, say, like this Nestle issue, when you try to run down, you know, who's making the decisions, there's nobody that you can really contact within the structure that is, you know, that is in charge. It's always somebody else. And it's kind of like within the whole structure of the system, there is a sense that no one is responsible for anything. And I think
maybe right there would be one of the fundamental conflicts or tensions between Christianity, which cause us to be responsible and to be responsible people, and say capitalism, or at least this particular structure that we call capitalism now, where there is a sense of diffused or non-responsibility, and which the structure, like you said, is also supported legally within the legal structure of the society. A professor of mine made the wonderful comment that you can kind of turn around our legal system, where we are innocent until proven guilty, in terms of we are not responsible until proven responsible for our actions. And so I would see that as being one of the real differences, a real tension between the structure and our faith, is this idea of responsibility.
Isn't in a capitalistic society,
great, give me eyes.
Isn't in a capitalistic society where really the only way for your little business to survive is to fight, hard, compete against whoever else has the same type of business that you have. And in that competition, to keep your business alive, you're stepping on everybody's toes. Or it's not just always an economic thing. It's not just trying to make profits. It seems to me that that there's a terrible contradiction, I think, between capitalism and Christianity. I think they are not heading in the same direction, because it's such a strong competition that we don't hire the handicapped person or somebody who won't quite produce as much as our money is worth, we think of what will get the job done fastest or produce the most, but we don't think that maybe that handicapped person or that 80-year-old person may not produce as fast or whatever, but they may need that job. It may be more helpful or more loving for us to hire that person. It's not always a money issue. It can just be in your small business in some small town that this capitalistic type of weight that's always on us to keep ahead so our business isn't crushed and we don't concern ourselves with some of these, people that we could help or...
But look how convincing the rationalization is, which is very simple. It won't do any good to be loving if I go out of business. So I can't keep on loving the handicapped person if I go out of business. So the problem cannot really be solved by that individual business, I don't think. That's why it takes public policy. See, if we have a public policy of subsidizing the hiring of handicapped people, so that the business can continue to make a profit, stay in business, and maybe the handicapped can do it. But I think you're pointing to it.
That's what I agree.
Have you read Kropotkin on competition? Kropotkin says, don't compete. Competition is always the ruination of the species. He says, from every part of nature comes the dictate to cooperate. It's through cooperation that the species survives. The competition, as a built-in irony, what's the object of competition? The object is always to end the competition. When you get into a foot race, you don't try to keep the race going, you try to get it over with. And same happens in Venice, so it's a really difficult tension. Let me just add, so it's kind of a balancing thing, in case you think that's going to help you to an answer. Cooperation also doesn't work if carried to the extreme. If cooperation has a built-in contradiction, that if everybody's just cooperating all the time, they use up all their energy organizing the cooperation and deferring to each other, and nothing ever gets done. You can't get through an intersection driving a car just by cooperating. You say, well, after you. No, then nobody gets through. So both cooperation and competition have these built-in paradoxes. Yes, sir.
Well, for a long time, I've had a notion, and I don't know where I got this, and I don't know whether it's right, but I've had this notion that if there were any political system, economic system in place, if it were only operated by plain, ordinary, dopey human beings without certain modifying influences, which I'll specify in a minute, that because of their nature, you pointed out that in the capitalist system, the principal human nature element that you see is greed. Well, I suppose in others, like maybe in socialism, it would be a lust for power over people or something, or
you're still greed.
The insane lust of the bureaucrat to stymie everything by bureaucratic procedures. What I'm saying is that there's some kind of tyranny that comes out of any economic system. Certainly any economic system you can look around the world and see, whether it's ours or some other Western country or a third world country, there's tremendous tyranny where a lot of people are enslaved in one way or another or just plain given a raw deal. So the moderating influence that I see is, for one moderating influence, is Christianity. And it's the way it serves moderating influence in capitalism is to alleviate some of the oppression and some of the tyranny that this system brings down on us otherwise.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.